This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Do you know what park rangers do? Have you ever considered becoming a park ranger? Well, it might be time to sign up because we have a shortage of park rangers. It was only a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about this, and we were talking about the vital role that rangers play in protecting precious environmental sites like Squeaky Beach. So this is Jordan Crook. He's from the Victoria National Parks Association, who spoke with us about the need for more park rangers and his disappointment with the state government for their lack of action in this space.
We've got our lowest park ranger numbers now since the Kennett government. Yeah, it's really bad at the moment. So we need more park rangers. Unfortunately, this current government isn't really valuing our parks and our protected areas. They're cutting back on programs like education and interpretation on park rangers, on pest management and the like. And it's really very, very short-term thinking, you know, try and make a gain now, but the weeds get worse, the damage gets worse, the parks get handed over to the next generation in poorer condition.
So Parks Victoria has recently spruced for applications for park rangers. They've advertised 62 new roles across the state. So how far will 62 jobs go in protecting our parks? And also coming up in this half hour, why is public art always so debated? From the Yellow Peril to Red Stairs, do you care about public art?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So Parks Victoria has put out applications for park rangers. They've advertised 62 new roles across the state. But those who already work in the sector say that hundreds of park ranger jobs are needed. So how far will 62 jobs go? And do you even know what park rangers do? Would you put your hand up to become one? Lee Mises is with Parks Victoria, is the chief executive of Parks Victoria. Lee, would you agree that we have a shortage?
Good morning, Rochelle. Well, I think 65 new rangers will bring our numbers up to over 600. So that's more rangers than we've had since 2020. So lots of boots on the ground as we really get back to basics of an organisation, and, you know, improve the management of visitor assets, improve the management of our environment, and really enable all Victorians to get out and enjoy our national parks.
So 62, and yet we're hearing that around 240 jobs were lost over the last 3 years. So since 2020, if that number is closer to 240, is 62 going to cut it?
Look, so important, I think, to make the distinction between our frontline rangers and, say, our back office roles in the organisation, as well as those roles that we have that are fixed term about specific projects. So ranger numbers have increased from about 460 in 2020, as I said, up to about 611 once these latest roles are recruited to. And whilst we have had some changes to particularly back office, which has then enabled us to create some financial capacity to put more boots on the ground, I think we're a stronger organisation for those changes.
So the jobs that you've advertised, the 62, are these frontline or are these back office?
These are all frontline. So these are rangers, people that are out in our parks every day, working with visitors, delivering conservation programs, maintaining campsites and visitor facilities. So they're really diverse jobs. No 2 days are the same. And I think they're fantastic. You get to work in some of the best parts of the state every day.
There's so many questions that I want to ask you, but we do have some calls and I want to get to those as well. So stay with us. Lee Mises is with you, Parks Victoria Chief Executive. We're talking about park rangers and whether or not we have enough. Ravi's in St Kilda. Hi, Ravi.
Hey.
Welcome. What did you want to say?
I was just curious if you had to live in non-metropolitan Melbourne in order to apply.
Oh, yeah, good question.
Jobs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the idea of rangers just being in regional, remote or coastal areas or inland. Lee?
Now, look, our rangers are importantly part of the community in which they work. So the jobs that we're advertising at the moment are right across the state, including in the greater Melbourne area. So, you know, there are opportunities everywhere from, you know, the northeast in our maritime area, so working on things like the Yarra River or on Port Phillip Bay, so right across the state, not just in remote regional areas.
What's the pay like? There's a text here that says rangers are not paid well. You need to up the pay in order to get good applicants.
Yeah, look, the ranger roles that we're advertising have a pay range of between around $59,000 up to about $79,000. But importantly, there are lots of opportunities to progress your career with Parks Victoria. So these are ranger roles. We have senior ranger roles. We have ranger team leaders, area chief rangers. And in fact, some of our executives started their careers of rangers. So whilst these are sort of starting roles, there are lots of opportunities. We really invest in our people. So if people want to make a long career with Parks Victoria, and we certainly want to see that, there are, you know, many, many opportunities.
This message is from Alan, and it says, my cousin was a parks ranger in the Victorian Alps. He described his job as a glorified rubbish collector. What do you say to that?
Well, certainly, unfortunately, we are seeing rubbish being dumped in some of our parks, and, you know, that becomes part of a ranger's role to make sure that, you know, when people are getting out into the parks, they're clean and they're safe. But, you know, again, it's part of a job that entails everything from, you know, working with volunteer groups to maintaining tracks to delivering education programs for school kids. So, no, it's not all just about rubbish collection. That is
the training adequate? Because we are actually going to have a chat with Jordan again in just a moment, who raised this as an issue for us. And to be honest, the calls and the texts are flooding in. So this is something that people, Lee, are very passionate about. But is the training and the education for park rangers up to scratch? Is there enough of that?
Look, you don't need a university degree or anything like that to become a park ranger. In fact, we want people to have diverse skills and different backgrounds. So, you know, you could come in as a chippy or an electrician, or, you know, you could have an education background or a community engagement background. And we do provide that on the job training. So everything from four-wheel drive and chainsaw use to community engagement. And we're really looking to build and strengthen that induction program. But I think importantly, these jobs are part of a team and well-established team. So learning from people who've been on the job for a long time. We've got some really experienced rangers who love to share their knowledge with people who are new to the organisation. So, look, there is a lot of investment and a lot of on-the-job learning that comes with these roles.
Spargo's in Edith Vale. Oh, beautiful part of the state. Hi, Spargo.
G'day, Rochelle.
What did you want to say?
My son works as a park ranger from Talangada, but he's only one of three that covers an enormous area of that northeast part of Victoria. So they, you know, they run off their feet really in order to get done what needs to be done. He's only been working there for 12 months. Prior to that, he was with Forest Fires Victoria, and he moved across from there, working basically out of the same central office. But they get paid a lot less. The Forest Fire Victoria recently got a pay rise. He's doing the same sorts of job when he's working on the fires, when he's seconded, and he's getting paid less than the others. So pay is a significant thing. He's only getting roughly on average about $30 an hour, which is pretty poor.
Does that mean that he's questioning the longevity of that for him as a career, Spargo?
Well, I think he moved across because he has a bit of a longer-term plan of maybe working in Canada for a couple of years in a few years' time. So his mates at the Forest Fire Victoria thought he was mad moving across. across because they thought the conditions that they had were much better. But anyway, so he's, I suppose, accepting reluctantly that at the moment he's getting paid less.
It's interesting that you mentioned two sort of fire experience because, Lee, there's a text here that says, criteria, question mark, my son is an experienced horticulturalist. He can't get an interview for a ranger. He meets all of the criteria, but almost all of the rangers are CFA or fire experience. Are jobs being given to ex-CFA or current CFA or fire-based people over others?
Look, certainly fire management is something that we encourage our rangers to do, but fire management in our parks is predominantly done by Forest Fire Management Victoria. So our rangers almost provide surge capacity, if you like, into that organisation. So it's not a core requirement for a parks ranger. In fact, horticultural skills would be highly valued in managing our parks, but people do have the opportunity to get involved in fire management too.
I'm so glad that Glenys in Pakenham has called through with this question because that was my next question. Morning, Glenys.
Good morning.
What was your question?
I was wondering why they don't employ more Aboriginal people because we've travelled around a fair bit and they're doing a good job in part of the Flinders Ranges and the Kakadu National Park. So why aren't more...
Indigenous rangers, yeah. And some areas I know do have a few, only a handful of them. Are there any, do you have criteria, do you have numbers or quotas to hire Indigenous park rangers?
Look, we work in really close partnership with traditional owners right across the state. We have a number of joint managed parks. So, you know, the traditional owner corporations themselves will also employ rangers. But as part of this latest recruitment drive, we've got six of the ranger positions are what we call designated Aboriginal positions. So positions that are only available to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And that really is about us continuing to build our partnership with Aboriginal people, with traditional owners across the state, and really delivering those good outcomes and supporting our traditional owners to realise their aspirations in caring for country.
I don't know sort of what the background is to this particular comment that's been sent through on text, but it says 62 rangers who are now just applying for their own jobs. Were jobs lost? And then as a result, people are now reapplying for their own jobs?
No, not at all. These are new positions into the organisation as we really strengthen our front line. And as I said before, getting that back to that basics of being a really good park manager, a really good conservation program deliverer, and a really good partner with the many volunteers and community groups that we work with.
Just finally, a question here from Sue. What about genders? This is all sounding a bit male-oriented. I'm not sure what made Sue think that, but I'm presuming, and one would hope not, that this is not going to be based on gender at all?
Not at all. We are an organisation that is absolutely committed to diversity right across the organisation. So we want people of different backgrounds, of different genders, of different skills right across the state because that just makes us a better organisation and I think a better park manager.
Are you happy with the numbers? Or do you think 62 is enough?
Look, 62 brings us up, as I said, to over 600, so 611 rangers across the state. That's a lot of boots on the ground. And, of course, they're supported by, you know, our education specialist teams, our conservation specialist teams, our infrastructure teams. And that's an important thing to recognise with an organisation like Parks Victoria. We have about $191 million worth of big capital projects across the state at the same time. So... you know, they have specialists. We have, you know, rangers I think the sort of the heart and soul of the organisation, given their frontline and community facing, but there are lots of support teams and specialist support teams that are also committed to delivering those really good outcomes for Victorians.
I said this is my last question, but I've got another two quick ones. People asking about age and part-time. So one person is 64 and another wanting to do it part-time. Is it worth them applying?
Absolutely, I would say. Look, again, diversity, that's, you know, age in diversity and age is another important thing. People bring different life experience to the organisation, which only makes us better. And part-time is something that, of course, we're willing to work with people. We support flexibility in this workplace too.
Thanks for answering all of our questions, Lee.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Lee Mises is the Chief Executive of Parks Victoria. And this was actually brought to our attention from Jordan Crook, who's the Victorian National Parks Association. He's with those guys. And Jordan, a warm welcome back to the Conversation Hour. How do you feel about listening to all of that? 600 boots on the ground, to quote Lee. Is that sort of bringing it back to where you think it once was or where it should be?
It's definitely great to see more park rangers coming, but we went back and looked back at the Parks Victoria annual reports, and in 1998 we had 913 full-time equivalent workers at Parks Victoria, and at the moment we have 801. So even with these new roles, we're still well below the numbers from 1998.
So why are people leaving?
People aren't necessarily leaving. The conditions are definitely an issue, but there's still not enough funding there. So these people look after 18% of the state, the most beautiful places that make our state what it is. But the money is just not there from government. It's just not a priority for this government.
To educate, train, and to, I guess, just put more rangers in where they're needed?
Yeah, it's been a massive blind spot of the Allen government in general. It's not just the park rangers that have been cut. There's been cuts to forest fire management, wildlife officers, fisheries officers as well. We're really trying to balance the books on the back of the environment and our wildlife, and it's not going to end well.
So if people are, Jordan, there are so many texts coming in, there's a lot of interest in this. I could imagine that with all of the issues that are there, it would be a great job. I don't know whether I'm looking through rose-coloured glasses, but I look at the rangers that I've met over the years, that I've seen, that I've witnessed. You know, I've got texts here from people who are regular walkers and what they see. There would be a lot to love about this role.
Absolutely, absolutely. I work really closely with the Victorian Protected Areas Council, which are about 60 or so park rangers and protected areas workers that got sacked in the last 2 or 3 years. And they've started a group to keep looking after the parks, even though they lost their jobs. Like, once you get these parks into your heart, you love them forever, and everyone loves them. 50 million plus people visit them every year. So we need to resource them and look after them properly, because they are really the best places in this state. They make it what it is.
62 jobs, it's better than nothing. Would you just like to see that added to over time?
Absolutely, absolutely. We need 65 this time of the year, and maybe in 6 months' time another 65 would be good.
Good to get your thoughts on this, Jordan, and thanks for raising it with us, because there is a lot of interest in people taking up these roles.
No worries. Thank you. Thanks for caring for our parks.
Absolutely. Jordan Crook there from Victorian National Parks Association. So would you become a park ranger? Maybe you have. Would you take up? Would you apply for one of these 62 new roles? Oh, good question here, and I didn't ask this. Julia says, Rish, does this include marine rangers? I'm aware that they were also cut and our waterways are currently really vulnerable. People breaking the law around things like catch size. I'm sorry I didn't ask that question, Julia, but given the interest, I think we might be covering this for a few weeks to come.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So Rob sends this. Rob here from Summers, as a frequent visitor to Victoria's high country and other areas of our state. I think we are in the midst of an endangered thing, and that is our park rangers. Good luck even finding one. That's a really good question. Like, when you're out bushwalking or visiting or surfing or whatever it may be, going for walks, how often do you see a park ranger? So whether it be the vault, the yellow peril, or the red stare, public art, it often like it falls into ruin. And then we debate it. We debate if it's money well spent and whether or not it should be there. So the Red Stair, you may not know it, but well, maybe you've walked past it and not realised. So it's down on South Bank. It's at the end of the promenade. And this is the latest one that's being debated at the moment. So it was installed back in 2006, and now, like so many pieces of public art, it's got graffiti on it and it's kind of been left to decay. But the City of Melbourne, it ran a competition to try and replace it. But sort of a year later, no one knows what's going on. Like, is it going to be replaced or is it going to be fixed? So what do you think? I mean, whether it be the Red Stair, the Yellow Peril, or if there's just some public art in your city, in your street, in your town, should art be fixed? Should it be replaced? Are you happy to have your rates and your taxes spent on public art? Do you think that it's important? But Rob Adams is the director of Adams Urban and is actually one of the creators of Red Stair, which is being debated at the moment. Rob, how do you feel about some of the words and terms that are being used at the moment? I mean, the Lord Mayor, Nick Rees, has said that it's embarrassing. Others have said that it's just gone to rack and ruin. It's been labelled as ugly and untidy. That must be awful for you to read.
Not really, because first off, it was never meant to be an artwork. It was as part of the legacy for the Commonwealth Games in 2006. And people might remember that South Bank Boulevard used to run through to Queensbridge Street, and it was truncated and a public space was created. It was part of three projects. It was the space on the South Bank where the Red Stair is. It was Sandridge Bridge, which had the sculptures and the story of migrating to Melbourne, and the North Bank, where there was a connection back to the station. And really what it was that it used to be an entrance into the casino car park, still is an entrance into the casino car park. And when we looked with a very small budget at how we could actually improve that as a public space, one of the things was to work with Australand, who were developing the building next door, get them to raise their building so we could slide the entrance of the car park out of the public space. But then we had to cover it with something. And the Red Stair became a temporary solution for a performance space, which could be used in conjunction with the open space. Made of plywood, it was never predicted to last 20 years. So,
no.
there's a lesson. Don't provide something that's temporary because they do hang around.
The idea of public space and how it's used, something artistic, something bright, something colourful, and for it to change and morph. I mean, why was it kept there for so long if it was never intended to be there for so long?
I think the thing with that is people, and you can see it coming out in the press commentary at the moment, that there isn't a budget for it. And so it just gets left and painted. But I take you to a similar project, and it's a little cafe on the corner of Little Collins Street and Swanson Street that has Brunetti's have just opened a new cafe there. That's in about 1994, when Swanson Street had just been closed, was a project we did, and we didn't have any money then either. But what we did is we actually designed the cafe. We worked with Akio Makagawa, who is a public a sculptor, and created a piece of public art, and there's a chessboard, and we created a public space. And we put it out to tender for someone to operate it on a 30-year lease. Well, that 30-year lease expired 2 years ago, and Brunetti's then refurbished the cafe, and you've got an ongoing legacy of activity onto a public space. Now, that process is exactly what needs to happen at Queensbridge Square.
Yeah,
it's not a piece of art. It's a place for a cafe to sit. So you can stop and have a coffee. You can overlook the public space, and you can be part of it.
It's interesting when you look...
just needs to get on and do it.
Yeah, when you look at... public art and public space, and how often is public space not actually for the public and not to be used by the public, but when it works well, it can bring the city alive and bring people together. We often love to debate it, though, don't we? Like, we like to be like, oh, I don't want my money, I don't want my taxes, I don't want my rates spent on that. Why is it always so contested?
Well, understandably, I mean, with a lot of public art, not everybody gets the value that comes from that. But with public spaces, I think there's a very simple principle. A public space is only as good as the activities that surround it. If you think of all the public squares you walk through in many cities around the world, they usually work not because of what you dump in the middle, but in fact, what exists around the edge that enables you to sit there, have your coffee, maybe watch something that's temporary on the square or something like that. And that does not have to cost money. That can be done through private public partnerships, and the city did many of them. I could name 10 during the time that I was there, and those were using other people's money to improve the public realm of the city. And that's, I think, where the thinking needs to go on the Red Stair, not to replace his art.
But yeah, how it's used and how it brings people together and access. You're listening to Rob Adams, who's the director of Adams Urban, who is one of the co-creators of Red Stair, which is being debated at the moment. Is there some public art where you live or public space where you live, and is it used and utilised well? Rob, you were actually formerly on the council. You are the director of design.
Yep.
How have you seen our view on public space and public art change since your time, since your tenure when you were at Melbourne City Council?
Well, I'm obviously biased. I came in 1983, to help write the strategy plan for the city's conversion, which was adopted in 85 in a very enlightened council at that stage. And they had no money. And so the strategy was not about big projects. It was about incremental improvement, how you take what you value in Melbourne and you improve it over time. Things like the paving and the furniture and public art was a big part of that. And in fact, I had public art in my portfolio for about 8 years. And I think the city did that really well. And in many ways, it concentrated on a lot of the smaller things that were just fixed. And in many cases, people, I think, if you get a young person now walking across the Bluestone and you say, well, in 1985, there were only three areas of Bluestone, outside Parliament, outside Treasury, and in the city square, they would say, oh, is that so? But it's that care for the public realm that is really important about cities. There are five things that make cities work: that you've got enough people there, that you've got enough uses so they can actually find everything they want, so it's mixed use, that you're well connected, so you don't have barriers that stop you moving. High quality public realm is the fourth. And then local character. Do it in your city's character, not copy something from some other city. We don't need a High Line, because we don't have a redundant piece of rail infrastructure to build it on. So don't copy New York. Do your thing. And I think that's a very simple recipe that cities could follow.
I love everything about that. Are we doing it that now, though? Do you believe we're building a lot of stuff, but are we following those five principles, do you think, Rob?
I think the city's still following those to a certain extent, because there was a series of projects coming through, and I think you've seen with Metro that in and around the Metro stations, things have been fixed up. So yes and no, but I think there's always the danger of going for the big glorious projects and forgetting the housekeeping. And it's the housekeeping incrementally over time that makes cities better.
Rob Adams is with you, Director of Adams Urban, one of the co-creators of Red Stair. Asking about the public space and the public art where you live, are you happy to pay for it? Do you think that it works well? This text, Robin, it says, I do wonder what happened to the art that was to be in place in Olinda after the major storm a few years ago. Money was raised, but nothing's added. So where has that money gone? And I want to have a chat to Trevor, who's called through from Ararat. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you both?
Really good. What did you want to ask?
Well, there's two parts, if I can ask. Rob, my name is Trevor Andre. You can get my details off the producer if you ever wish to talk further with me or try and get councils in on this.
Yes.
I'm a big advocate of foodscaping. I've actually had masters
from all over the world come to my farm at Ararat to talk about foodscaping in a survival sense. And where I'd like to put that into what you're saying is, if you look at when you go to beautiful places like where I'm in the Grampians, you go to Halls Gap and there's like a beautiful garden there and it's got lots of art installations, but it's also got fruit and food and stuff like that. I think there needs to be some integration between the public space and actually something you can actually get from that, not just the aesthetics, not just the, oh, wow, that's quite a trippy or whatever, but where there's some part of it. You could make beautiful arbors and things and all sorts of art installations, but make it that it literally feeds the city, you know, and you've got the councils running those parks. They could just sit there and say, oh, I've just been sprayed. Please come back in 2 weeks and give me a wash before you eat me or whatnot.
I like the idea of looking at how we can do this regionally and the public space having a secondary use. I don't know, Rob, what do you think?
Look, I agree. I mean, not in every location, but I went to Guadalajara, the second city in Mexico, and they put orange trees down the middle of their roads. And there's an understanding in the community that you can't pick the oranges until they have a festival when all the oranges are
ripe. Oh, I love that.
And I just thought, what a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
Because people actually look at those trees with some value. So we've got.
It'd be so tempting, though, wouldn't it, when there's a beautiful orange ripe and ready to go?
I know. I'm watching the kumquat tree outside my window because I make kumquat jam with my granddaughters.
Beautiful.
You know, and when it's ready, you go and do it. So I think, yes, we can have productive environments that also have value. And, you know, one of the easiest ways to change a city is to plant trees. And, you know, a lot of people who left Melbourne and came back 10 years later said, can't believe how green it is, because the city put through an urban forest strategy and it's been greening the city consistently now for, you know, 30 odd years. And so trees you go down Collins Street and see weren't there in 1985.
Mm.
You know,
everyone Swanson benefits, Street, don't they?
Swanson Street, which again was a project I was responsible for, was, you know, criticized, and there's actually a planning regulation that you should be able to see the shrine from Victoria Street. Well, you can't now because the trees actually cross and shield that view. But you would never want to get rid of those trees. They make that street.
Wow.
And so, you know,
gosh, you've done some incredible stuff, Rob. I could speak to you for hours in terms of how you've shaped our city and the you know, the things that we take for granted, things that impact our lives or that are integrated into our lives that you've put that thought into. I just do want to finally ask you, because Red Stair is being debated at the moment. It was supposed to be replaced by a competition. So it was, you know, I think $25,000 cash prize for the winning submission. Is that the best way to go about it? And this was put out internationally as well. And so you said earlier, you know, don't copy New York, don't copy other cities, do what is unique to your space, to your suburb, to your city. Should something like public art be put out for competition?
I think public art should be, but there's a process that happens before you get public art. And if you look across the river from the Red Stair, there's the Turning Basin. And when we did that Turning Basin, which was to cut back in where the original first harbour of Melbourne or port existed, we got a gentleman by the name of Peter Stitt. And we said to Peter, we're going to do this and we want to curate some public art that will actually reinforce the memory of this place. And he came up with a few things. The prows that sit on the jetty there are symbolic of the ships that arrived, Faulkner's ship and all the ships afterwards. You know, he put a blue light, underneath the viaduct, actually turned it from, you know, engineering into art. There are three buoys that sit out in the river that show where the river was before the basin was cut out. And then at the back, there was an installation in the city square called the Scar Trees. And when that finished, I had it relocated into that park because that's where the original waterline is. So you can imagine, You know, that's the first meeting place in Melbourne. That's why Customs House is across the road, because that was the port. And, you know, those things about memory are so important.
Yeah.
And so you need to curate it before. You can't just come and plonk something and hope it's going to work. It's got to have a purpose. And I believe it needs to have some memory and relevance to the place it's in.
Fascinating. Well, as I said, I could speak to you for hours. Are you happy, just finally, Rob, are you happy for the red stairs to be removed? Are they done?
Should have gone 20 years ago.
Said from the man who created them. Rob, thank you so much for your time. Good luck with the Kumquat Jam.
Okay, thanks.
Rob Adams, the director of Adams Urban, who was the co-creator of many things, it turns out, including Red Stair. Dan's in West Brunswick. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Yes, it's a wonderful topic. I think you should have this topic on quite often. There's so much.
I know. I could have spoken to him forever. I couldn't agree more, Dan. What did you want to raise?
Well, I want to raise, this is all very good, having, you know, site-specific works and everything. There's a number of wonderful pieces throughout Melbourne. But unfortunately, a lot of it's kind of withered into neglect. What's happened over the years is that major works by international sculptors in particular have been kind of put to one side. And it's good to know that they are being looked after somewhat, but there's still a number of works that have been hidden away and should be moved to proper places along South Bank. Hussein Velamanish, for example, a wonderful, long, extended work that went back into the development areas behind, was half of it was shown off, and others looking worse for wear. So it's okay to have all these wonderful pieces around, but why not put some money, invest it, to ensure proper maintenance?
This is cleaning. The issue. It's always the issue, Dan, whether it be the vault, the Red Stair, it's the maintenance. And sometimes as the public, we're happy to have it built. And isn't this gorgeous? Isn't this lovely? Isn't this colourful? Isn't this controversial?
Yeah,
but then are we happy to pay for its ongoing maintenance?
Yes, yes, a good point. But I think I'm glad you mentioned vault, not the yellow pearl. That's one of the things that really aggravates sculptors and artists and people in that industry, to name it by its proper title. And also, it's really good to acknowledge the sculptor's name, Ron Robertson Swan, a very major mid-century.
I drive past it every day, Dan, and it needs some TLC. You know, the repairs on it have been covered over in the wrong colour yellow, so, you know, like a really dodgy paint job. It's got weeds all around it. You know, so it's a bit of a shame. Dan, thank you. Just speaking about Rob Adams, this text has come in. It says, Rob's the best! Exclamation point. I worked as a freelancer for him for 35 years. I watched him transform the city from a hole to a beautiful place to be day and night. We've also been talking about park rangers and whether or not you would become a park ranger. There are 62 new jobs that are out there for park rangers. However, those in the profession are saying it's not nearly enough and that we need more park rangers. When was the last time you saw a park ranger? When you went walking? When you went hiking? This, Rish, I regularly see park rangers in the Victorian bush. If you just hold a free party, like a doof party, then they come out of the woodwork. But another asking how long that park ranger funding is for. These roles are probably not ongoing. Having more rangers is good, but maybe the roles are funded only for a short period of time. Lulu's in Eltham. Good morning.
Good morning, Rochelle. I'm a little bit nervous. I've never rung a radio
before. Oh, don't worry. Don't worry. You'll be fine. Yeah. What did you want to say? Thank you for calling.
Oh, that's all right. I was coming home from the supermarket and I just had to stop and call you. My partner is a park ranger, and it's just horrendous. It's horrendous. The pressure that the pressure that I know that's put on him. They've just got no funding for anything much. No funding for environmental stuff, which I would have thought would be a top priority.
So, what sort of funding? What's horrendous, Lou? Explain to us what the things that irks him.
Well, they're not being funded for environmental works, like, you know, getting rid of weeds, hiring contractors to do stuff like that. They're not. What is the other thing? Oh, look, I'm just really nervous.
Oh, don't. Yeah, you're doing really great, Lou. So he's just frustrated, yeah.
Well, extremely frustrated because they're just not getting the help they need. They're not allowed to say anything to the public. Like, there's a lot of destruction of toilets.
Mm.
Like, you know, vandalism of toilets. So the toilets don't actually work.
Mm.
They've got no money to fix them unless they can fix it themselves, which I don't think they should have to do.
So what does his job involve, Lucas? I mean, there was text before saying, oh, God, it's just a glorified rubbish collector. And, you know, if you're cleaning toilets or if you're telling off...
Well, I mean, you've got to do that because who else is going to do it?
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's employed as a... was employed as a... well, still is, as a, originally as an environmental ranger. But, I mean, he gets sort of thrown everything pretty much. The park that he works at, a lot of the rangers work at home part-time, which I don't know. I'd like someone to explain that to
how
me.
How that works.
Yeah, I really would
like to. Oh, Lou, no, you've done great, Lulu. Thank you. Hey, can I ask you a second question? Because you said you've just been to the supermarket, right? Because
yeah,
I'm about to talk about supermarket specials. Do you buy what's on special? Do you believe specials anymore?
If it's a product that I normally would buy, I buy it if it's on special. I mean, even if I don't need it, just to sort of because it's on special and it's cheaper. But I don't look at catalogues or anything because I actually don't have catalogues delivered to me because I got a post office box.
Yeah. So, I know. I still love a catalogue. I still flick through it. When I go to Aldi and they say, do you want a catalogue? I can't say no. Sometimes I say no and then I'm like, oh, actually, yeah, give me a catalogue.
Well, I do read catalogues if I'm visiting somebody and they've got the catalogues on the table.
I know. It's one of my favourite things to do when I was on maternity leave was sit down and read through all the catalogues. Lulu, you did beautifully. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Rochelle, and I love listening to you.
Oh, thank you. 1-300-222-774. I mean, that's the thing, right? Like Lulu, do you read the catalogues to look for specials? Are you thinking, okay, here's how I'm going to do my weekly shop this week. Here's where I'm going to go. Like, do you actively seek out what's on sale and what's on special? And do you believe them anymore? We know the Consumer Watchdog's lawsuit against Coles is underway in the federal court today, with a supermarket giant being accused of basically doing fake discounts on hundreds and hundreds of products. So do you pay attention to what's on special? Do you think it actually makes a difference? Ever since the watchdog brought this to our attention, I now lift up the little flap thing to see what the original price was. And then there's times where you feel like you're suckered into buying two items when you only want one. So do you pay attention to the specials? And do you need things to be on special in order for you to meet your weekly groceries? Phil Slade is a behavioural economist. Phil, it kind of made all of us question, actually, is on special actually that special? And sometimes when you read the fine print, you realise you might be saving nothing. Has it changed how we shop?
Great to be here and to chat with you again, Rochelle. Yes, it has to a degree, but specials aren't anything new. We remember growing up where there was always the big sale sign in the shop window, and specials and sales have been around for a long time. And they've been around for a long time because it works. I think what's changed is that the science has gotten better. And so we understand a bit better now why they work, and so it's got a bit more refined and targeted. And that's really the interesting thing. It's not that they help us save or do things. They're essentially engineering our attention and then our perception. And so when you think about it as attention engineering and then perception engineering, it's fascinating. And that's why everything's red or yellow, for instance, because red and yellow is the way that our brains see something that's threatening, and so it draws our attention. So, you know, on your own, your phone, and you get the little red dot, which means that something needs to be attended to. We're more likely to attend to that, right? It's the same science. But then when they've got your attention, how can they change your perception of value? And that's actually what works. And it really does work. And it's changed the way that we look at individual prices. It's not just whole shop sales now. There's individual specials on individual items because our brain works in different ways and they've figured out how to engineer that perception value much more now.
Is there ever a time when you are genuinely getting a good deal where you're like, wow. So if something is half price, for example, and it's on a product that you buy all the time, so you go, right, I'm going to stock up. Surely then we're actually getting a good deal, or are we not? Because we've bought a heap of other stuff when we're in there that we didn't want to buy. So in the end, the house wins.
Well, I think this is the real trick, right? So there'll be a certain number of things that you'll have a lot of information about. You normally buy them and you kind of can sense how good or bad the special is. And so it might be on your really common items where it'll be genuinely half price and they'll genuinely discount it. But what happens in our brain is that we then think that all the other specials that are around that are just as good because we have less information about it. We kind of just trust it because if it was right for the toilet rolls, then it must be right for the sausages that are on sale. But we may not know as much about pork sausages, for instance, that we do about other things that we buy all the time. And all the supermarkets and chains can do this. And I suppose that's where the supermarket chains can get into a bit of hot water, because if you think everything is on sale like those common items that you might know and they're not, then all of a sudden you get sucked into sort of maladaptive spending behaviours.
Given the inquiry and that's underway today as we speak, has it changed? So I've got texts like this. Mel says, I have Aldi and Coles and Woolies. I have all those apps on my phone. I'll stop at all three on the way home to keep costs down. Others saying, I have a watch list. I have that app as well. I check each week what's on special, so I buy from there first. I save a lot. Just finally, I guess, has something like this inquiry, has it changed how we go about what we buy and how we shop and the sort of research that we put into it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the great thing about those apps or what those people texting in are doing is they're making the decision or they're planning before they're in the environment.
Mm.
So before they actually get to the shop, they already know what's on special and what they're looking for. So the environment has less of an impact on their decision making. And it's a great way to do it. I think my wife is exactly the same. She loves shop hopping on the way home, and she'll less do the weekly shopping now. She'll shop for 1 or 2 days so that she can get the best specials, and she designs essentially the food that we have in the house around what's on sale, and she saves an amazing amount of money. I go to the shops and buy exactly the same things and seem to spend twice as much money as she does. She's incredible. It's like a superpower that she has, but she does that. It's like, I know
because she's researched.
She does it in action.
Yeah.
That's right, you know, and she takes it on. She sort of loves almost the game of it to
wow,
sort of embrace
that's a
that.
Superpower. I only wish I'm
you
every night
both.
I'm like, what am I going to do? What am I going to cook for dinner? What do I need to buy?
They trade on that. So often when you go to the supermarkets and you're tired and you're exhausted and you don't really want to be there, you kind of are relying on this information that's sitting in front of you to say this is actually on special, because you just don't have the cognitive capacity to do anything. And I suppose when you're in that space, that's where the responsibility of the supermarkets have to making sure that they're influencing your perception in a truthful way, not in a deceptive way.
Well, it certainly made us think twice about specials. Really good to get your thoughts, Phil. Thank you. Phil Slade, behavioural economist. How many supermarkets do you stop at on the way home? One of my best mates I know goes to 3 supermarkets a day, loves it. I think there's a supermarket addiction. But if you've just joined us, we've been talking about public art and public space, Red Stare, which is that sort of bright red amphitheatre down on South Bank Promenade, along the walk there. It was supposed to be removed a very, very long time ago. We spoke to the original creator of that. He wanted it gone about 20 years ago. So what is the importance of public art and public space? Some wonderful texts coming in. Rish, outside the town hall, there are planters with herbs in them that the community can use. And another says public art in Geelong, our wonderful bollards have been left just to deteriorate over many years. The council has finally woken up, but there's no real solution. These painted bollards are a tourist draw card, but they are just not valued by the city. Well, John Mutsers is a community artist. He's a sculptor. And I think, John, at one point you wanted to turn Wonthaggi into a destination, a sculptural town to be known for. How on board are people even in the regions with public art and public space?
G'day, Rochelle. How are you going?
Really good.
I think public art is something that's still relatively new in Australia, really. We have lots of it, but we don't necessarily recognise it as public art. And a really good example of that are the blue trees. Are you familiar with the blue trees?
Where are they again? I feel like I can see them.
There's 14, more than 1,400 of them right across Australia. And it started as a bit of a prank with a young man who and a friend who painted one over in Western Australia. Then a bit later on, one of the young men committed suicide. And the family...
That's right, yes. Now I remember.
Turned it into a charity. And now they're popping up everywhere. And it's just such a great example of, you know, it wasn't intended to be an art piece, but it has become an art piece.
Mm.
And now there's more than 1,400 of them around Australia. And when you drive past there, everybody, you see one in the paddock way down.
Yeah,
and
say, I know, that's right, yes. Oh, it's all
and
coming
it
back to me now. Yeah.
And
what Rob Adams was talking about earlier too is sometimes the thought and the vision, it isn't necessarily to stand out, it's to integrate into our lives and to change how we move around a town or a city.
Yeah, social interaction, dialogue, all of that sort of stuff comes really well on the back of sculptures because of their three-dimensional nature and the way they occupy spaces that paintings generally can't do. So that's really important. And I think what Rob Adams has done, he should be known as a sculptor of the spaces between us, I think, because he's turned Melbourne into an absolutely great place. And then all those little ideas with he was talking about a little cafe, and that is an art space now, really. You know, your coffee is one thing you go there for, but you're immersed then in an art space.
I love the idea of it, just being integrated into our lives. John, thank you. How close are you to turning Wonthaggi into, like, you know, a recognised sculpture town?
At the moment, we're working on getting the old tech into a cultural hub in the town. So we're still on the board, and I don't know how close I am.
It'll
so
get there.
It'll get there.
It'll get there. That's it. John Mutzers, thank you. Community artist, one step at a time, trying to turn Wonthaggi into a sculptural town. You know what? There's lots of you out there when we were speaking about whether or not you buy things just because they're on special and do you believe the specials and how many supermarkets do you go to. Sal says, supermarket shopping has become a sport for me too. You'll find the two majors, alternatives, certain items, you can't get them, things are on sale. I've become very aware of those specials aren't really specials. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.